George Dilla's short story collection, Nothing More to Tell, was published by Mayapple Press in 2011. His short stories and personal essays have appeared in numerous journals and earned several literary awards and prizes. A native Detroiter, he now lives and writes from the Lake Michigan shore town of Ludington. Today, we're talking to George about his new book, a collection of three stories called Working Stiffs, published by One Wet Shoe Publishing this past May. Congratulations, George. Tell us about your new book.
It is a book that contains, as you said, three stories, and they are all about work in one way or another. And so it seemed like a natural thing to put the three together and to make a chapbook. You know, it's really hard to find a publisher who publishes fiction chapbooks. Lots of the publishers publish poetry chapbooks, but finding one that would publish a chapbook of short stories...
Yeah, I have to admit, I hadn't seen one before, George. This is new for me, a chapbook of stories.
Well, I think there should be more of them, don't you?
I do. I think it's a great idea, especially with our short attention spans.
Well, especially at the pace that I write very, very slowly. I might finish two stories a year, maybe three stories a year. And, of course, I do a lot of other kinds of writing, too. But it'll take me a long time to come up with enough stories for a full collection. So this was really terrific. This allowed me to publish a book, and One Wet Shoe Publishing loved the idea and loved the stories. And all three stories had been in one literary journal or another over the past few years. And so we just pulled them all together and made a little book out of them. None of the stories, by the way, are called Working Stiffs. That's just the name of the title of the book itself.
No title story.
No. But and we all know what a working stiff is, right? I mean... You know,
it doesn't have a positive connotation to it, does it? And none of your stories, well, they all have dark humor to them. They all show, I don't know that I would say negative, possibly, but the difficulty, the constraint of working in, whether it's corporate America or in one case, in one of your stories, you go back to the Old Testament.
Right. One of my working stiffs in the story called Shaft Men is a soldier in Joshua's army.
Yeah.
And so, of course, the big event there was the taking of the city of Jericho. I grew up a good Baptist boy, so I know my Bible, you know. And so I reached back for that one and made it a contemporary story, hopefully. So that one is the working stiff is a soldier in Joshua's army. In another one of the stories, he works for a large marketing department of a computer company. And the third story kind of has two working stiffs. One of them is the man, Martin Harpoonian, who owns the company and has just sold it, but his whole life has been devoted to his work. And then the other person in that story who's kind of a working stiff, although they're all working stiffs, is his assistant who actually tells the story.
And I have to say, George, you're a master of leads. I remember that from your previous story collection. You always like to open your stories with a bang, like the very first one, The Sounds of Harry Being Murdered in the Office at the End of the Hall are the only sounds, the grunts, the thumps. That's wonderful.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. I think that you really, you know, it's not necessarily trying to find a hook or anything like that at the beginning of a story, but I think the beginning of a story is probably the most important part of the story. It has to give the reader a reason to continue to read. I think everyone who reads short fiction or long fiction, for that matter, is reading to answer a very, very simple question, and that is to find out what happens. I mean, that's why people read, to find out what happens. And so if you start off a story giving them something to think about, giving them something to worry about, giving them something that they're already involved in, and then and then they continue to read on to find out what happens. So really that's kind of the key to story beginnings, I think.
So do you think, George, that short stories are making a comeback? Or, I think they used to be more popular and then we were more into novels. Are they starting to come back? Is that maybe because of our time constraints, our shorter attention spans?
Well, I wish I could say that I think they're coming back, but I really don't. It used to be that you'd find an Ernest Hemingway story in the Saturday Evening Post or something,
Yeah.
I mean, everybody in the country read short stories. I mean, they were published in the most popular magazines. And now, it's kind of stunning. I've got to tell you, sometimes disheartening. First of all, no writer likes to be asked the question, oh, what do you do, when somebody first meets you? Because the last thing you want to say is, I'm a writer, because then there's so much explanation that has to follow that.
Mm.
But one of those explanations, well, what do you write? Well, I write short stories. I write short fiction. And you would be surprised how the blank looks you get. Like people just really don't have an idea even of what a short story is.
Wow.
Is that, like you write for the newspaper, or is that like an article, or, so I wish I could say that short fiction was coming back. I wish I was involved in something that was a really, real go-go industry right now. But regrettably, I'm stuck with what I do, and that's to write short stories. Do you think they're coming back? I hope you're right.
I see more of them, but yeah, I'm listening to you with interest, but in a way, I think you might even have a better feel for the pulse of that sort of thing. Over in Ludington, you've got a whole literary community going on there. And in fact, I was going to ask if you use that community to process your stories. How long before you stick a fork in it when you write a story? Do you have a group that you use?
Well, we do have a group here, a pretty active writing group, and also there are some other folks around this, around the state. In fact, one that you just interviewed a few weeks ago, Andy Mozina, is somebody else that I share work with, and Ludington Visiting Writers here is really, really a valuable resource, and they've all had a taste of my work and have, given me help in understanding, where it's going and what it needs. So yes, indeed, and the wonderful thing about it is that these people are really like reading. I mean, that's, I think, the key is, you have to find people who really like to read, And if you can find those who will be willing to read your work, so much the better.
You've had a big hand in developing that community in Ludington. Can you tell us a little bit more about what's going on there in the literary world?
Well, we have... I started the organization about 12 years ago. We started it as a reading series to bring people to Ludington to read their work. We kind of put Ludington on the literary map. Lots of people would love to come here now to read for us because we treat our writers really well when they come here. And so then it's spun off from there to doing conferences, workshops, of course, our local group, which meets twice a month. We've had open mics. We've had a thing called Story on Stage, which is really popular, where we have actors actually read contemporary stories in a setting, kind of like a cabaret setting, which is really kind of nice. And we've had some writers come up for those to hear a kind of a professional actor read their work, and they've never heard it. I tell you, they've never heard it read those that way before. Would have somebody like that.
That's probably an eye opener because not every writer is a good reader.
In fact, some of them are absolutely dreadful readers. You know, and probably
I was resisting saying that, George.
Some of them tell me, you know, I just hate to read. Oh, I just, you know, I don't like to be invited to readings. I will read anytime, any place, anywhere. I just love to read, but not every writer shares that, I'm afraid.
Yeah. You've also said that you've written lots of bad stories before you wrote a good one. What makes a story a good story?
Oh, boy. I think that it has to be something that really holds the reader's interest. This is the way I look at it. There are no new stories, okay? Every story that's told is a story that's been told 1,000 times. These stories that I have just written are not particularly new. There's always been stories about people having difficulty at work, stories of betrayal, stories of difficulties. My stories in this collection aren't like this, but you know, there have been endless stories about divorces and endless stories about illnesses and endless stories about, parents dying and spouses dying. And, you know, these are the things that stories are about, but there's nothing new about those stories. They've all been told over and over again.
Yeah.
So the thing is really how the story is told. It's not the story itself, because there are no new stories. It's how the story is told. Can it be told in a fresh way? Can it be told in a way that the reader will keep the reader's interest, maybe thinking about that story in ways that they haven't thought about those issues before?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really the key, you know, to do it in an artful and interesting and fresh way.
Yeah,
that would be what makes a good story, I think. And as far as, you know, when you know a story, I heard somebody just recently say you don't really finish a poem, you just abandon it, you know.
Mm.
And I think that's kind of true with stories, too. You never finish a story. You never, when you're writing it, you never say, okay, this story, you just say, give up on it. Say, I can't change it anymore. I can't make it any better than this. I don't want to work on it anymore. It's done, you know, and you just abandon it and put it out there for the world, and hopefully the world can respond to it.
Yeah. Now, you're retired these days, but I understand back in Detroit you were in marketing advertising yourself as a working stiff?
I was a working stiff. I was in the advertising business for 40-some years.
Did you bring some of that to that one of those stories? Some of your experiences, the murders, perhaps?
Probably there's a little bit of that in all of them, actually.
Yeah.
But, you know, I had some buttons made up of, you mentioned earlier a few minutes ago that the term working stiffs is kind of a derogatory or negative term. You know, I had some buttons made up as kind of promotional pieces for the book that say, I'm a working stiff.
Yeah.
And to me, and people have told me, oh, I wouldn't wear that. But more people have taken them eagerly and said, hey, I'm a working stiff. I'll wear that. You know, I mean, it is almost like a badge of honor to be called a working stiff rather than necessarily, you know, anything negative. It's something we've all had. We've all done, right?
Or we've all done battle together, huh? Veterans
yeah.
of the workplace.
Except maybe Mitt Romney. I don't know. Maybe he's never been a working stiff, but the rest of us.
So what's next, George? Are you working on a new collection, or what's on the way next?
Well, I'm always working on stories,
mm-hmm.
and I've begun to write some personal essays as well, and I've had some luck having had those published, and maybe one of these days I'll even have enough to make an essay collection. I don't know. So I spend most of my time either writing stories or writing essays, and always writing two or three at once so that if I get stuck on one, I can go over to the other.
So you work on several at the same time?
Oh, sure. I think that I wouldn't be surprised whether most writers do that, because it's really easy to kind of get stuck on one. And I wouldn't call it writer's block necessarily. It's just that a lot of times your brain has to work on that story by itself for a while. If you set a story aside, if you run into a problem or not knowing quite what to do or where to go from there,
yeah.
If you just set it aside, your brain in the background continues to work on that, and suddenly,
true.
You know, the answer will come, you know, in 2 or 3 weeks or whatever. But in the meantime, you can go and work on something else.
You don't have characters jump from one story to the other?
Sure, absolutely.
Oh, great.
You know?
I love it.
Yeah.
All right. Are you planning...
Or poems, right?
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Are you planning any readings in Kalamazoo, George?
Well, yes. As a matter of fact, there is going to be a reading at Kazoo Books on the 28th of June. Thanks for asking.
Oh.
Philip Sterling. Do you know Philip?
Yes.
Philip and I are doing a workshop that day at Kazoo Books. It's the 28th of June, a Saturday.
Okay.
We're doing a workshop on flash fiction and the prose poem. We're doing the workshop together. And then after the workshop is over, we're going to do a dual reading. So that will be Kazoo Books on the 28th of June.
That sounds great.
Everybody's invited.
Can you give us a little taste of Working Stiffs, perhaps a short excerpt?
I would be glad to. I think I'll just read a couple of paragraphs of the story called 90 Million.
Okay.
Which appeared a few years ago in a publication called Driftwood, and it was called 40 Million at the time. And you know, I think the way the economy is going, I decided to make it 90 Million for the book. You know, inflation.
Okay.
This is a story about a man named Martin Harpoonian, who started a company when he was a young man, and now he's an older man getting retirement age, and the company is very, very successful. They make plastic moldings of all things, and he has just sold his company to a big conglomerate for $90 million, and he immediately has seller's remorse. Thinking, what am I going to do for the rest of my life now? And the person who's actually telling the story is his assistant named Howard Barnacle. So I'll just start and read a couple of paragraphs. 90 million. Martin Harpoonian had no sooner finished signing his name to the dozen or so documents placed ceremoniously before him on the conference table and received in exchange $90 million for the purchase of his company, Harpco Molds and Plastics, and he closed his eyes, lowered his head, leaned close to his lawyer, Meyer Kottman, and whispered, "Tell them I changed my mind. Tell them to keep their effing money." I, Howard Barnacle, assistant to the president of Harpco, witnessed this moment, possibly I alone. Others gathered around the long table of the Bank of Commerce Executive Boardroom were too busy to notice, otherwise occupied talking into their iPhones, rummaging in $1,000 Dunhill briefcases, guzzling Evian, thoughtfully provided by the bank's hospitality director. And this is how the extraordinary moment had occurred. Harpoonian had checked the time on his $20,000 gold eval, then signed away his company with his own 59-cent BIC. Followed by a pause, eyes closed, and the blunt, whispered instruction. "It was the fastest case of seller's remorse I've ever seen," Kottman told me weeks later. So, now, you must read the rest to find out what happened.
Exactly. Always a pleasure talking to you, George, and reading your work. Thank you.
Thank you for talking to me. I really appreciate it.